Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 94 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Dan Webb is able to join us for the whole show this time. Good to have you back, Dan.
Yes, finally, I'm here for the whole thing, and hopefully there'll be more of that as we approach the end of the semester, but it's good to be back for the full time, so thank you.
We're glad to have you back. We'll probably have fewer Dan Webb jokes this time, though, but hey.
I don't know if that's necessarily true.
Okay. And that's the voice of Rob Mark. He's also co-hosting, as usual. Hi, Rob.
Hi, guys and audience out there. And I think all of us are entitled to see Dan's ID. We want to make sure that it's really Dan. Dan, would you hold your ID card up to the camera, please?
Yeah, we can't do video
oh,
conference.
Oh, darn. Skype. Yeah, that's right. But, okay.
Not yet, anyway.
Rob, if you're threatening to do pat-downs, I'm leaving.
No, I think that's beyond me.
And that's David Vanderhoof. He's our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Good evening, folks.
Our guest this episode is Jonathan Heckman. He's the founder and writer of the JetCheck.net blog. Jonathan attends Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. He's working on a Bachelor of Science degree in Aviation Business Administration. He's also a student pilot and logs hours in a Diamond Eclipse. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Coming up, we have the week's aviation news. David's going to have his This Week in Aviation History segment. And we've got a great Australia desk report from the Plane Crazy Down Under folks. And as usual, we received quite a bit of listener mail, so we're going to be able to go through some of that, I think. But why don't we get started straight away with the news? You guys ready? The first article comes from Business Day. This is Airlines Want Payouts for Overreaction. Well, the fallout, as it were, from the ash from the Iceland volcano is kind of becoming a thing of the past. Airlines are getting back to their normal schedules. But there's some issues concerning the financial impact of that event. In fact, the chief of the International Air Transport Association, that's Giovanni Bisignani, says that for an industry that lost $9.4 billion last year and was forecast to lose a further $2.8 billion in 2010, this crisis is devastating. He says airspace was being closed based on theoretical models, not on facts. Now governments need to look at how to compensate the airlines, he said. I'm the first one to say that this industry does not want or need bailouts, but this crisis is not the result of running our business badly. So what do you think? Is it legitimate for the airlines of the world to seek some government subsidy, if you will, for the effects of this?
Well, oh, I think what they're looking at, I actually was watching an interview of Richard Branson on some channel earlier this week, and I think the precedent that they were using is, well, the American industry got a decent bailout after 9/11, so why don't we get one?
Okay, but you know what? In the United States, let's face it, we have Democrats and we have Republicans, and all the Democrats are known as the people that like to help everyone, to make everybody feel better, and to make sure that the people that are really in trouble don't fail. And all the Republicans are the ones that say, no more bailouts. It's rotten business. And now we have the airlines asking for bailouts. However, let's be serious. If one airplane had gone down because they tried to fly it in those ash storms, this would be a whole different story.
Oh yeah. And that's one criticism I think is a little unwarranted from IATA. Is just from what I've read, and I'm no engineer, is just that there isn't enough data. Well, hasn't been enough data to figure out what's a safe operating environment. And obviously, it's better to be safe than sorry. Now, from what I've read, and maybe you guys have been following this closer, is now with some of the test flights that some of the airlines operated, is now there's more data to kind of figure out where the airplanes can fly safely, like what amount of mass is safe. I'm not sure if I'm reading that correctly, but
yeah, I think it's something that that really hasn't been measured or examined in any great detail in the past. I mean, certainly you don't have a large number of opportunities to do testing of that sort. And I guess it just hasn't really been done. There just isn't the data to accurately predict what levels of ash are going to cause a problem, or what types of ash, or all those
issues. Can I tell you something? I don't know that I agree with that. I think there has been plenty of time to do research. I mean, since Mount St. Helens and the
Indonesian,
what is it, redoubt up in Alaska, and there have been volcanoes that have gone off before. They just don't want to do it. I mean, it happens so seldom that my guess is that no one can even figure out who would actually come up with the money to pay for the research. And they just kind of say, well, you know, we'll get to that. It's not a real high priority right now. And then something like this happens and suddenly they make it sound like the sky is falling. Well, actually, I guess in a way it is, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Now, just to build off that, there was a very interesting press release from Finnair a couple days ago. And this is a quote from their CEO, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce his first name was Mike. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the last name because you guys would just laugh at me. But
we could laugh at you anyway.
But the Vilanian, whatever. You know what?
It's okay.
I'm sorry to Finnair. I respect you guys. I just can't pronounce.
Go with Mike.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, I know the first name was Mika, but the last name, whatever. Anyway, and he said, companies in a weaker economic condition are making strong demands for help. A subsidy stampede would distort competition because the risk of airlines using that system for wider support would be great. We are already seeing support that contravenes the EU state aid rules. So basically, is Finnair saying, we've lost 20 million euros here, but we don't want state support. Now, I'm not sure what the motivation is there. Are they, I guess they're afraid of airlines, possible competitor airlines, getting financial assistance in the future. I'm not sure what I haven't seen much rhetoric from specific carriers on what they want, other than BA or Air France has said it a little bit. It's more been from IATA. Is Finnair seeing, well, one of our competitors is weak. We don't want to support state aid, so we can. I'm not sure, but it was just interesting that at least one carrier is saying that we're opposed to this.
Yeah, sure. Jonathan, what do you think? Do you think this is just a case of airlines, you know, saying, well, might as well ask because you might get something, or do you think they really deserve it?
I think a bailout is probably, you know, necessary. I mean, just like as Dan mentioned with the 9/11 bailouts, that was 3 days on the ground for U.S. carriers, and they got $5 billion in bailout money. Hmm. You know, I think maybe some, not all, but
no. I'm sorry, I still disagree. So it's cost of doing business. When you run a business, you have to be ready for extraordinary circumstances, and I just don't think it's right. Yeah. I don't think you can have it both ways. I mean, we have elements of our economy that demand bailouts. And we've given it to them, but I don't think that necessarily means we have to accept every offer as it comes along. I just don't.
Well, it seems in terms of areas like foreign ownership, they've been very, very adamant about, you know, governments keep your hands off. And the way I see it, and I think this is what you might be saying as well, Rob, is that you can't have it both ways.
I think that's what I meant when I said you can't have it both ways. But
wait, you said that exactly. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just kidding. No, that is true. I just don't think it's make a decision. Either you believe that certain industries need to be supported or they don't. And if we've already had so much grief in this country from support of the auto industry and of the banks and everything else that people have said, look, enough, this is a stupid idea, except the airlines say, except that, you know, for us, it's kind of necessary because we're kind of in trouble. I'm sorry, I draw the line somewhere.
Because on our Facebook page, because I just want to promote that, is a listener, Peter Johnson, I hope I'm saying that right, but apparently Ryanair has come under scrutiny here because the EU has much more stringent consumer protection laws.
Sure.
Than we do.
Right.
And basically, customers have been saying, okay, well, we've been stranded. We should be able to file our expenses like food and hotel with you, and you should compensate us. And Ryanair said no.
I thought Ryanair said they were going to do it. I thought that's what
they said no at first. And then they put a press release, Ryanair will comply with unfair EU 261 regulations.
Oh.
But I just found it interesting because I actually think that Ryanair has a point here.
But it is the law already in the EU.
Here's the actual law. Article 5 and item 3. And it says, an operating air carrier shall not be obliged to pay compensation in accordance with Article 7 if it can prove that the cancellation is caused by extraordinary circumstances which could not have been avoided even if all reasonable measures had been taken.
But that's like a free insurance policy.
from the way I'm reading it, is it almost seems like O'Leary has a point here, because if you're not going to count a volcano under extraordinary circumstances, what?
Yeah, what would does? You count? Right. Yeah.
So why did O'Leary pay it? Of all people, I can't imagine him rolling over easily on something that seems. I agree with you. It does seem to be very, very clear about that. But there's obviously some piece of this that we're not missing, you know, or that we're missing.
Well, the only other thing I can think is why some airlines might not be. Be asking for the fighting this is because they want to beg for the bailout at the same time, but maybe someone over in Europe who knows these rules much better than I can write in over the course of this week and provide some insight, because I just found that interesting.
Do we have any listeners in Europe?
Well,
of course we do.
Yeah, oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's why we brought Paul Filmer on, because we weren't connecting with Europe enough.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Outside the United States, it's just amazing, I think.
It's called the internet, Rob.
The internet. I like it.
Yeah, yeah. And see, actually, it's a series of tubes. And,
yeah. And they run under the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it's all run by gerbils on treadmills, of course.
Mm-hmm. Listen, I just got through watching Ratatouille, so I get the rodent thing. It makes sense to me.
Mm. Good movie. Yep. Good movie.
Yeah. Good movie. Okay.
All right. Well, all right. Speaking of rats, let's move on to our next story. This is from USA Today. IRCT US Airways ends merger talks with United. So we've seen in the press the reports that United has been talking with US Airways. United has been talking with Continental.
And US Airways is considering hot, sweaty, three-way merger action with US Airways and Continental.
And it's just not going to happen, it seems. US Airways has ended their merger talks with United after learning that United prefers combining with Continental Airlines. Now, here we have yet another source close to the situation at US Airways, in this case, has said that the executives were upset with their counterparts at United, with whom they thought they were close to a deal. And this is a quote from that source, that unnamed source. They feel like they were played by the folks at United.
You mean in the sense that maybe the whole United US Air thing was just a ruse to get the Continental people to move? I can't believe that.
Well, two things. First, Max, see, this is why we need a soundboard like the Australians, because then we could have the Days of Our Lives theme song in the background.
Oh, that's a good choice.
I think United, yes, has always hoped that that Continental will be the better partner, but I still think, to use an analogy, if it's last call at the bar and there's only, you know, certain girls left, you go with what you can. So I still think well, that's actually
going to get some letters on that.
To our female listeners, direct all your mail to Dan Weathers.
Okay, fine. And from the other hand, if you're a lady and it's Les Cole of the bar and there's only me left, you go with me.
Good recovery.
But I still think United, while they would have preferred US Airways, prefer Continental, I still think they would have gone through with US Airways if they could have.
Hmm. As opposed to not going through with anybody? Is that what you mean?
I think both carriers were so big on consolidation rhetoric. I still think it would happen. That being said, I still think Continental is a more natural fit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, honestly, Dan, when you weren't here last week, we were talking about that, and I could not for the life of me figure out why anybody at United would try to come together on a merger with US Airways when they have such horrible labor problems. And actually, United has some pretty terrible labor relations too.
The big issue with the labor relations is there's still a phrase in the US Airways pilot contract that if there's a deal, US Airways pay rates go back to pre-bankruptcy levels.
I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah, I like that part.
Hmm. Okay, still within the.
I wasn't done yet. I was waiting for other people. I'm sorry. Yes, but I'm feeling if this happens, it seems like I think United would be the name. I would only like the deal. If this is the way I've been reading it, is that it seems that it would not be Glenn Tilton leading the carrier.
Jeff Smizek.
Jonathan, why do you think that?
Well, I actually read in an article that if the two carriers were to combine, the airline would be based in Chicago, and Tilton would become a board member, and Smizek would be CEO. That's just the rumor. But I think that makes it far more attractive because, Smizek and Continental seem to be working out great. Tilton and United, I don't know.
Yeah, but think of all those jobs in Houston. Oh, my Lord. Moving a headquarters from from Houston when it where it's been for the last, what, 70 years? Oh, boy, I can't imagine that's going to be real easy to get through.
Well, supposedly it would be a major operational base. And I think they would keep the hub. I still think Houston, network-wise, I don't think that would be cut.
But just consolidate the headquarters.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it'd be great for Chicago, but yeah, not so great for Houston. At least for the corporate jobs.
Right, right. Well, I guess we'll see. You know, who knows how long it's going to take for this to play out.
Tune in next week for another episode of Airline Soap Operas.
And it'll be right after the announcement of the tanker selection.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Right, right. All right, we have some of the quarterly revenue and earnings reports coming in. Let's see, we have Delta. Delta's showing a $256 million loss for the first quarter, although that's a lot less than the same period a year ago. Let's see, what else do we have, Dan? Southwest has got a slight profit.
Yeah, right on target. Alaska posted a nice little profit, a little bit better than expected. Continental a little worse than expected. We had AirTran, they had a loss, and then American. And actually, to be honest, I think in terms of earnings, and feel free to disagree with me, it wasn't that much of an exciting week. We really didn't see that much in terms of exciting announcements along with earnings. The only airline that really announced anything along with earnings was Alaska. Basically, they announced a couple new routes, one new Hawaiian. I think they're doing San Jose, Costa Rica from LA at some point. Maybe I'm not remembering that correctly. And then they're standardizing the checked bag fee, hiking up the first one to $20. But the first three bags will be $20 each, which is a nice little cut considering the third bag used to be $50. And the one thing I like about Alaska is they've actually the thing that pisses me off about bag fees is you're charging the customer and they're not getting anything additional. So Alaska's modified their bag guarantee a little bit, but in the past it's been if your bag's not out in 25 minutes, we'll give you 2,500 miles. They've lowered it to 20 minutes and 2,000 miles, or I think they'll give you a voucher as well. And I like that just because it's now an added service. At least I feel like if I'm paying for my bag, I have higher expectations than I did in the past. So, but one thing I did find very interesting. In American's earnings call, and this what I really like. This is from the analyst Jamie Baker, J.P. Morgan, and so the other analyst had interesting questions, but his was the most interesting. I wish we could, you know, for copyright reasons, get audio on here. But he said, "I don't want to beat the bush around here. You have the highest costs. You have the lowest margins. You are the only major airline expected to lose money this year. Your year-to-date equity performance has trailed that of your peers. In other businesses I can think of, when there is a company standing out like this, you sort of expect a major overhaul. And it isn't clear to me that Flight Plan 2020 is that plan. I'm trying myself to find a reasonably intelligent question here. I guess that's to be, is this really all you have? Is this really all you got?"
Yeah, what was the response?
Let's see. CEO Gerard Arpey said, "I think that the pressure that all the airlines are facing, profitability pressure, is no secret to you or anybody. That by the fact we are the one network carrier that did not file for bankruptcy, we have plenty of significant labor costs, a pretty significant labor cost advantages versus all our network peers, which tends obviously to depress our operating margin relative to those companies." Which, okay, and he went on for a little bit while longer. Nothing too exciting, but yeah, that's true. But I feel that I feel American. I love you, but you haven't done anything exciting over the past couple of years. Definitely you have a labor issue there, but everyone has labor issues. But I it almost seems like that's been an excuse that the company's been resting on for a while. But I have to read some more in the results. But I just found it interesting to hear such a frustrated analyst.
So if a stockholder were in the right place at the right time, say a year ago, they could have probably made some money on some of these airlines, couldn't they?
Yeah, and I was actually looking at the performance, and just 2010 has been good performance, but the past 12 months have been simply fantastic. Actually, I was listening to a very interesting Bloomberg podcast. Last week, and it basically had an analyst on. It was mainly about the volcano and merger discussions, but he was talking about the industry, investing in the industry as a whole. And he said, you know, if you're really not an active investor, it's not great. Like, so if you're someone who's just putting away like $5,000 a year into a Roth IRA, don't do the airlines. You'll probably get hurt.
Hmm.
But if you're an active personal trader, they are absolutely fantastic. So a year ago, if I invested in American a year ago, I would have made 43%, which is just about even with the market. But here's one that's more astounding. If I invested in United a year ago, I would have had a nice 258% gain.
Not bad.
Yeah, so the industry's actually done well because, I mean, airline stocks had been beaten down. In 2008, you had oil prices, then you had the economy. So the industry's made a nice recovery. And they have favored some of the network carriers with some pretty impressive gains. But some of the regionals done well. Pinnacle almost 300% up. So depending on your stock, it's been good. Only a few of American carriers actually only did poorly in the first quarter. I think only, AirTran, Mesa, SkyWest, and Republic and ExpressJet for the first quarter of this year actually lost value. So,
and where's Mesa at these days? I thought they were the next one that was going to go completely away.
Well, Mesa is in bankruptcy. I think the last SEC filing I saw is they're basically writing off the entire Beach 1900 fleet. Really, they haven't been doing anything else. The stock's delisted off NASDAQ. It's on the pink sheets. It's trading at 9 cents a share. Mesa's kind of between a rock and a hard place right now. Especially what basically United said, yeah, we really don't care about your Dash 8 flying anymore. We're going to get rid of the CRJs. I think Mesa was saying that, I don't recall the history correctly here, I think, but basically that they would be able to do some CRJ 700 flying in exchange for 200s being cut, and they're fighting with United. So, yeah, Mesa's not in the best shape right now.
Way to go, Jonathan. Different, the other Jonathan. Ornstein, I was thinking. Had anything to do with that, Jonathan.
Hey, be careful. Last time someone in new media criticized Mesa, which was the Plain Business Newsletter, which is fantastic, they got sued, so let's be careful here.
Oh. Well, it's okay. If they decide they need to send me something, they can send it right to me, Dan Webber, should be.
All right. We have a piece from the Seattle PI Reader Blogs, actually. This is Spirit Airlines installs pre-reclined seats on new Airbus A320s. This is kind of fun. Spirit Airlines has been in the news a lot recently for their new carry-on fees. Where has it gotten them? Well, a ton of free publicity. People complaining. Oh, and a 50% rise in bookings, which is rather interesting. But now they're onto something else, and this is pre-reclined seats. But what this really means, apparently, is that the seats just don't recline at all. They're fixed.
And they're calling them pre-reclined.
That's right.
Well, I think Air France, they're putting a similar seat on their domestic A320 family fleet. And for some reason, Air France got basically no press on this when they did that. Wow. But I think they used the phrase natural recline.
Natural reclined this is great. Those are the marketing guys at work.
Overtime, I think.
Well, I think the difference for Spirit is they have some decently long stages, whereas Air France, they're only using this on flights within France. So,
wow.
Can I ask how many of you actually recline your seats when you're flying? Because, I mean, personally, I just feel terrible for the people sitting behind me, so I never recline my seats.
Yeah, same here.
You're the only one, Jonathan.
I don't either because I hate it. When I'm behind that, I was going to use an expletive, but I'm not. That idiot who decides I'm going to recline my seat and then for 3 hours I can't use my laptop. So no, I don't recline because I don't like. I will check if it's like the person behind me is asleep, then I'll recline. If it's a little kid who doesn't need the leg room, I'll recline. Or if there's no one behind me, I'll recline. But other than that, I stay upright at all times.
Yeah, I generally do too. If the flight is less than 2 hours, let's say, which was to me is a short flight. I generally don't either because I don't feel really the need to recline the seat. And, you know, like you're saying, Dan and Jonathan, it can impact negatively on the person behind me. So I just don't. Now, if it's a longer flight, then forget it. You know, all bets are off. If I'm going to – if I expect to be doing some serious sleeping or anything of that sort, then I'll make myself comfortable. But then usually on the longer flights, you know, I've got more seat pitch anyway to play with.
It can impact negatively on the people behind. You are really nice.
I'm disgusting.
Well, no. Max is only nice for up to 2 hours, is what we're saying.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah, then I'm a jerk after that.
Oh,
it's self-centered, but, you know.
Yeah, actually, John, I think you were going to say something, so I'll let you go.
Well, airliners.net actually did a survey. I can't remember when, but they surveyed, you know, all their users, and most of them, an overwhelming amount, said they don't recline their seats.
That's interesting.
And actually, Mary Kirby had an interesting post about this. And basically, I'm not sure if I'm remembering correctly, but basically, on a seat that doesn't have any in-flight entertainment, the most expensive thing is reclining. So by having seats that don't recline, you're reducing maintenance costs. And I believe these are also slim seats. And yes, which other airlines have put in, but basically,
meaning thin, like, right?
Yeah, like in Air France, when they put this, they're, I think on the A319, they're not adding an extra row, but on the A320, they're putting an extra row of seats, but it's still a slight increase of legroom for everyone on the plane. But Spirit's just cramming everyone in, 178 people, four people in first, I think it's four seats in first class, and the big front seat, as they call it, and 28 inches of seat pitch for everybody else. So
28, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, but to be honest, I kind of buy the argument. Like with Air France, they were saying you'll get increased space, no one's going to recline, and they actually increase legroom with this. But for Spirit, it does not seem to be the case. But you know, I don't see this as big an issue as people are making it. It's for the way I think about Spirit is your ticket will get your butt in a seat, and that's it. And if you don't want to pay for stuff, don't fly them.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well,
consumer's choice.
Well, yeah, and then the other thing I was talking to a friend about this the other day is Spirit is not your normal domestic carrier. First, they're an ultra low cost carrier, but they've shifted so much of their network over the past few years. Spirit is not just U.S. domestic. They've put so much capacity into South South America and the Caribbean. So they're you know, targeting different markets than someone like a Southwest or the other domestic carriers, mm-hmm. really. Well, they're looking for cheap travel to and from these other countries. So,
all right. Well, speaking of sitting in seats, we've talked about the new Department of Transportation regulations or requirements concerning fines for long tarmac delays, and several airlines, I guess five actually, have petitioned the Department of Transportation looking for waivers, and the DOT has ruled, according to their press release. The U.S. Department of Transportation denied the requests of five airlines for a temporary exemption from the new rule limiting tarmac delays. As a result, all U.S. carrier flights covered by the rule will be subject to its terms effective April 29th. And this is a quote from Ray LaHood, the U.S. Transportation Secretary. He says, passengers on flights delayed on the tarmac have a right to know that they will not be held aboard a plane indefinitely. This is an important consumer protection, and we believe it should take effect as planned.
And one thing I did find interesting is the airlines were applying for these waivers. It was mainly in the New York area and the newest areas with Philly. Basically, the JetBlue kicked it off with JFK saying,
right.
Okay, we have this new runway coming in. We already reduced our schedule, but we should be exempt until the new runway's open. And DOT basically said, no. But they did say, like if it's a situation like JFK, they do have discretion as to how much they want to fine people. So while it's been reported in the media, okay, $27,500 per passenger. That the DOT will determine how much an airline will be fined on a case by case basis.
Yeah, because it's up to that amount, that maximum amount.
Yeah, but to, you know, other than that, I mean, yeah, I don't think airlines should necessarily be doing this. But I'm with the camp that says this is going to mean more cancellations. There's an interesting comment on the ruling on the wonderful regulations.gov site by Daryl Jenkins, who's an airline analyst who is quoted in the media quite often. I don't want to be misquoting him, but the logic was basically on a domestic flight, the airlines, if it's a good year, is making about $600 per flight. So there's really not too much incentive to even try if there's even a slight risk to...
$600 a flight? What airline is this?
Domestically, on average, for a domestic U.S. flight. And basically, there's just not much incentive to run the flight if you're concerned about cancellations. And the point he was making, if load factors are above 80%, if you have one flight that's canceled, it's going to take another three or four flights to reaccommodate everybody.
Going back to what, you know, Continental Airlines, you know, Jeff Mizik said, and I quote, you know, you had these passengers that say really want to go to L.A. or Mumbai, but the government, by God, says we're going to fine you $27,500. And again, that's the maximum. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to cancel the flight.
Yeah, this is a real problem, I think. And there are lots of examples of, sort of theoretical, granted, but the likely situations where it just, you know, won't make sense. The best thing to do and the thing that the passengers would want to do is not return to the gate. There's a nice article in Swell Blog. Yeah, this is Tarmac Rule May Punish Passengers as Well as Airlines, and this is from written by Dr. Amy Cohn, who's the associate professor at the University of Michigan and also an affiliate of the MIT Global Airline Industry Program. And she kind of, you know, lays out a number of situations, weather related, mechanical related, that can have kind of unintended consequences with this new requirement. I mean, you could even have an example of maybe a equipment delay at some other flight or an equipment problem on some other flight that delays the arrival of the pilot for your flight. You know, should that impact you? Should the fine be, levied against the flight that's waiting for the pilot? Or is it worth it just to wait the extra 20 minutes and, be on your way? So there's just a lot of sort of unintended consequences, I think, that are going to come out of this.
Yeah, and I also get the sense from this fine that it kind of unfairly puts 100% of the blame on the airline industry, that it's all over scheduling. And can we debate that? It's like Continental and Newark have too many flights to operate efficiently. We can debate that, but I feel the government, obviously really not going to find themselves, could either maybe be local governments in developing airport infrastructure or be the federal government moving somewhere somehow on next gen. I don't think the blame solely falls on the airlines.
So what do we think is going to happen here? I mean, do you think we're going to see some really just outrageous, outlandish, and nonsensical situations occur, and then someone will wake up and say, okay, maybe we need to modify this requirement? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it'll be based on whatever the first fine will be.
Yes.
First time this happens, we'll see what the DOD does. If they ease them in, then I think the airlines will cancel less. If the first one is made an example of, where you have the maximum fine slapped on everything, then the cascade will begin and they'll cancel everything.
Yeah, and so let's get excited for summer thunderstorms since winter over. So we got a couple months, but let's hope for some really bad summer thunderstorms, and we'll see what happens.
Hmm. Yeah, but I mean, let's be serious. What was the point of the whole thing that Kate Hahn and I started, a couple of years ago? It was to somehow get the attention of the CEOs and say, hey guys, as the ATA guy, what's his name, David Castlevetter, the communications guy, told me, it doesn't happen very often at all, and I agree with that. However, saying that it happens 0.5% or 0.25% of the time, that's still a lot of bodies left out there on the ramp.
Yeah.
With no food, no water, and no Johns. And if they just figured out a way to address that, they never would have had any way to get this law through.
And then plus, I think, yeah, it's a small percentage of flights, but I think it's an even smaller number of flights that really got this moving. As I think the biggest one is the kick that was that ExpressJet flight over the summer, which was an overnight. But and actually, one thing, since you were talking about the food and the water and et cetera, is I think for the passengers on how they feel, I think a lot of it depends on product. So I'm not saying people would enjoy being stuck on a plane for an hour, but let's say that ExpressJet situation, okay, you're on a cramped little ERJ with very little, with very limited to do. Compare that to a Virgin America A320 when you have food available and you have, on-demand TV to entertain yourself. It's a little bit different, but
yeah,
that's another talk for another day.
Okay, Max, let's hear your fancy segue to the next one.
Okay, how about this? All right, well, Chicago is doing its part, I think, to maybe to ease the delays on the tarmac, and only their approach is different. They're going to shorten their runway.
Wow, impressive segue.
Well, apparently there's a $15 billion O'Hara Modernization Program, I guess designed to enrich the economy around Rob's place. And one of the longest runways, according to this article, at O'Hara International Airport will be shortened next month to make room for the construction of future runways.
Okay, it's Max, O'Hara. It's O'Hara.
It's O'Hara, yeah.
What did I say?
O'Hara.
As in Scarlet.
Well, you know how many times I've been through? I know better, too.
So maybe you want to do it again and...
No, I think he needs to leave it in, so he's joined the mispronunciation club.
There we go. Yes. All two of us. Boom.
No, actually, it's three of us. It's now everyone, except with the exception of our guest. But the night is young.
So Rob, what's all this activity going around, though? Is this just pork or?
No, this is the O'Hare Modernization Program. They want to go from to a sort of an LAX kind of setup with all the. The runway is essentially running east and west. And in order to start the next move in that direction, they want to build a terminal on the west side of O'Hare. And the only way to do that is to chop up part of 32 left. And that is the longest runway. I think it's 11 or 12,000. I think it's 11,000 feet long. And boy, on days I've been at O'Hare and watched some of those heavy 7.4s take off in the summertime, and boy, they sure looked like they needed every foot of it. I don't know how they're going to do it when they cut it down to, I think, what's it going to cut down to, 7,000, I think, or something? I should know this, but I don't. But
9,700.
Oh, 9,000. Okay. But this is Mayor Daley's thing. You know, he doesn't listen to the airlines anyway, so he doesn't really.
If it doesn't go well, he'll just like close the airport and just start carving X's into the runway for no apparent reason. But still bitter about that.
But Rob, why were the runways that long in the first place? The runways were that long because of the Air National Guard and the Air Reserve Base, the tankers in the 130s.
Oh, is that right?
They're no longer there.
Yeah, well, that's true. I'm sure that's probably true. So. I doubt seriously they would have been able to get this through with any of the airlines if they thought it was really going to be a safety issue.
Yeah. So dumb question. So if they want
you, that never happens.
Yeah. So if what happens when the winds are north south then? If that does this happen rarely or what's going to happen there?
I think one of the runways is going to remain one of the crosswind. Runways will remain a northwest southeast, but I think there will only be one. Right now, they're parallel 32 left and 32 right. And one of them's going to go, and one of them would be cut down.
Okay.
I believe the plan calls for six parallel runways total, maybe, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
And which I think that replicates almost like a DFW situation.
So basically, when the winds are east-west, it's going to be awesome. And when it's not, it's going to blow. Is that what we're...
Did you just say that?
You've been thinking of that for the last 5 minutes, haven't you?
No, I haven't. Actually, just rolled off the tongue.
Right. I think that would be accurate, though, Dan. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's actually a technical industry term.
Blow?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it is for engines. See, when I listened from episode... What was that? I think that was episode single digits.
The single digits, yeah. That was a long time ago.
Bang, suck, blow. That's what she said.
Yeah.
Please edit that out.
You got the squeeze. The squeeze goes in there, too.
Ah, yes.
Suck, squeeze, bang, blow. That's how a jet engine works.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, before we get into any more trouble, MarketWire reports EADS North America intends to submit proposal for U.S. Air Force tanker. Hooray!
So...
Another tanker story.
So, David, tell me how you feel about this. Don't hold back.
Actually, I thought this was an interesting article for one reason and one reason only.
Okay. What's that?
There's one line in it that says, EADS North America will build and modify the KC-45 along with A330 commercial freighters.
Yeah, that was kind of an odd.
I thought that was a very bizarre statement. Does that mean that they were going to move the A330 production run over to...
Maybe that's their game.
I don't know. Forget the fact that they're going to try to produce these tankers. That would be a really big argument for the locals saying, look, we're not only going to be producing it for the military, we're going to be producing it for civilians. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a larger production run. So you really need to take this program.
So where would they produce these?
Mobile, Alabama.
So same as originally, just sans Northrop.
Right. I mean, Northrop was the electronics contractor. They weren't going to be the manufacturer. They weren't going to be the primary builder. EADS was going to be the primary contractor. It's just they didn't think that they could go it alone without an American company. That's still left to be said, because I have a feeling that Northrop will magically appear again. I don't think they can do this by themselves.
EADS has a website up for this now. This has just been up a couple of days, so it's kind of fun to visit. That's www.kc45now.com. That's the EADS tanker site, if you will. The Boeing site at www.realamericantankers.com. So you can check the two of those out.
Once again, the marketing guys working overtime.
Yeah, they sure are.
So I feel, let's start a betting pool. So will this be finished? Will there be new tankers flying before the KC-135 turns 100? Because, you know,
yeah,
who knows?
At the rate it's going.
We only got what, 46 years left?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to do the math. No, it's less than that.
Oh, first flight was 56.
So yeah. So we would be hitting 50 at 20. We would be hitting 60 at 2016. It'll be close.
We've got to get this thing done.
Don't hold your breath.
I know.
I mean, by the time we have new tankers, I could have a white picket fence and 2.5 children.
Dan, I don't think I my question is more seriously, will there be a contract issued before the tankers turn 100?
All right.
I don't think we're even going to have you're betting on there actually be a contract issued and there would actually be tankers flying. I won't even go that far.
That's true. Now I find this interesting just cuz this has been like a more political football than anything. Just wondering, David. Depending on how midterm elections go, could that screw things up even more?
No.
Okay, just wondering.
It's going to Boeing at this point.
Okay.
This is all window dressing, or I'm sure there's a Rob term somewhere about fluff, but it is what it is. You know, until I still think the Russians will come along and they'll really want to push their tanker as a third party, and the merger will be considered by U.S. Airways, and Continental will want to become civilian contractors for the tankers, thus creating a civilian workforce, creating a better economy for United to take over everybody and become the world's largest strategic tanker force.
Just remember, folks, you heard it here first.
So basically, David, you're saying this is only delaying the inevitable.
Yeah, yeah. For this round.
The inevitable. That's the question. Was it always inevitable? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I have to think maybe is the Pentagon at least happy about this, that maybe some competition will make Boeing make some costs look a bit – make.
No, I think they're happy that there's a competition, so they don't have to say, "Well, we gave it." There was somebody else that they turned down.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it will affect anything Boeing's going to do, and I don't think Eads. I mean, the only way Eads is going to win this is if they suddenly come up with this miracle tanker that undercuts everything Boeing's ever going to do.
But they better do it pretty darn quick.
So basically you're saying they need to make the I can't believe it's not butter of tankers.
And they've got to do it with the fact that the British and the Australians are miserably unhappy with their product.
Really? I didn't know that.
They've got all sorts of delays and problems. So there's an underlying thing there. So it is, please God, next week for my birthday, God bless me, let's not have a tanker story. Thank you.
But maybe we could just have something from the plain crazy down under guys about what the Australian government is. What are the ruse thing?
Hey, Rob, you just assigned me homework.
Oh, that's right. Well, listen, I forgot you're a double dipper.
Yeah, it's your fault for taking on two jobs. Yeah. Don't even complain. That's your fault.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Dan. Hey, you know, well, Dan's all right. I like him.
Yeah, see, look, the first time. We've seen a Rob Dan Alliance.
Should we actually get our guest's opinion on this subject?
Well, I mean, I'm more curious to find out what you know, Britain saw the problem with it. David, do you know exactly what was wrong with it?
It's the boom. The problem is the boom system and the refueling system. Australia bought them without the forethought of building a reinforced floor, so they don't have the cargo structure that they could have had they bought a cargo version that was converted to a tanker instead of an airliner version to a tanker. And they have serious delays on it because of the way of the refueling system. That's the problem with Australia. Basically, they're, as far as a gas passer goes, it's not very good at what it does.
Okay.
Are you talking about me?
Yeah, I like that gas passer thing. I hadn't seen it before.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to...
Well, listen, one thing in the military that is moving forward is apparently Rob's favorite issue, which is UAVs. The Defense News reports the U.S. Army unveils UAV roadmap. Now, the U.S. Army is interested in UAV helicopters. It wants its existing helicopters to be able to fly without pilots. According to this, the Army would prefer to upgrade its helicopters to perform UAV missions rather than buy expensive new aircraft. And this applies to the Apache, the Chinook, and the Black Hawk. So, David, apparently the Army is looking for UAVs or unpiloted helicopters. I guess we do have some of these in operation already, right?
Well, no, we have all of those products in operation, but they're manned helicopters. The Department of Defense for the U.S. Navy just finished a program where they had the K-Max, and I forget what the other competitor UAV was, for what they call VRP, which is vertical replenishment, which is the from one ship to another carrying supplies over. They want to use unmanned helicopters. The Army, that's a whole nother ballgame. I don't know how this is going to come about, because I don't know why you would have a CH-47F or a UH-60M as a unmanned aerial vehicle, and I don't know any soldier that's going to want to get in the back seat of an unmanned aerial vehicle to be carried into battle.
Mm, yeah.
The Navy program was for supply. You weren't carrying people. The Apache that they're discussing here, I can see you're using that in sort of a Predator drone kind of fashion, where you're using a forward attack aircraft as a drone. But using a transport as a drone, that just blows my mind. I mean, hot and high climates like Afghanistan, where it's treacherous to begin with in a Chinook, mm-hmm. And you've got a full squad in the back waiting to deplane the aircraft. I can't imagine anybody wanting to get in that, knowing that in the front there isn't anybody in the front of that helicopter.
And what's the advantage of it in that case, too? You know, I can't picture the advantage.
I don't know. It doesn't. It's one less person to get shot down, but you still got troops in the back that are going to go down.
Yeah.
So the logic on this escapes me. If somebody out there, it's the fad, I think, is what it boils down to. How much can we make autonomous so that we don't have to jeopardize people and put people in harm's way? But in this case, I think you are putting people in harm's way, because you can fly supplies, yes, but anytime you're going to have a troop payload, you're going to have people in it, and that's going to be the one that's going to get shot down. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Now, David, actually, I think that gets out at a question I was interested in asking you. Let's look 30 years down the road. Like, what percentage of our military air fleet would be UAV at this point?
30-40%.
Wow.
I mean that's top end, but it's going that way. The technology is there. This is, I mean, they're basically saying that existing hardware are going to get converted. It's not like you're building a new helicopter. You're taking a UH-60 off the line. You're putting a couple of extra boxes in it, and you're building a mobile land station where they can fly the helicopter. It's not that far away. It's one of those, we're doing everything in our power to find ways to use UAVs. Eventually, it will go the way of, okay, that's not going to work. But right now, the answer, the government wants to put everything as a UAV. And eventually, they'll come back. It'll come back full circle. It'll come back to a balance point, but right now we're going way off on the other end.
Now, do you ever think that Emerge Continental United would ever pitch a UAV tanker to the Air Force?
Possibly. I want to know, will United Continental or U.S. Airways pitch a UAV airliner to the general public?
Boy, that's a tough one, huh?
Because I read online that there was some research going on. I think GE was heading it, but I could be wrong. I don't know how many times I said that phrase this evening, but that there've been research done in having more autonomy for cargo flights. I think it would be down to one pilot, not full UAV, but I just think, you know, maybe 100 years down the road, who knows?
Can I have that flying car with that pipe dream?
Yeah, I don't know, but that's true. We were all supposed to, Now, and I got your point, but I feel if this were ever going in an airline perspective, I feel passengers would just be scared silly.
Well, I think it's going to come to general aviation too, though. I think there will be a time when you won't need to go flying for fun because you'll be able to hook up flight sim and we'll be able to sit here and fly our Cirrus or whatever from our desk and they'll pump in the sounds and the smells and it'll be a whole lot cheaper. I mean, this is going to happen. I see it.
Oh, awesome.
Well, yeah. One thing that I think we will be seeing more of in the future is synthetic fuels. And we've...
Wow, Max, another fantastic segue.
And we've seen in the... This
a lot
from,
of news tonight.
I know. This is the last one, I promise. This is from Australian Aviation. Green Hornet flies for Earth Day.
Oh, and nobody believes them anyway.
But the Australians?
Yeah, come on.
Well, and it wasn't a Steve Creedy article, so it really can't be fact.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
So what's happened here is the U.S. Navy has flown an F-18 Super Hornet with a 50-50 mixture of jet fuel and a biofuel, camelina-based biofuel, at supersonic speeds, and this was to commemorate Earth Day, which was this past April 22nd. I think this is the first. Is this the first military use of? No, we did see something in a B-52, didn't we, David? Using biofuel, a mixture.
Late summer or something, yeah.
Yeah, but this is the first. I think this is the first. You know, jet fighter, something, you know, supersonic. This is, to me, this is like, you know, Ferrari, you know, running 50-50 biofuel.
I mean, it's impressive that the Navy's willing to do that. And the article also says that they've got 14, they've got a further 14 flights totaling 23 flight hours. So they are serious about this. This wasn't just one joyride. And they plan to use the type operationally by 2012. That's not that far away. So
no, it's not, is it?
They're really serious about this. And, you know, with all of the other debacles, we have a real quiet success going on in the Navy. And congratulations on the Navy for going green.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any idea of all the jet fuel consumed in the year? Any idea how much of that is military versus commercial versus anything else? I really have no idea.
I would assume that there's more military used. You think the civilians are obnoxious about running around and running with air engines on, going, but the Navy and the Air Force have no problem with sitting aircraft running full blast for 20, 30 minutes on a tarmac before they take off. So I'm sure they burn far more fuel than the air. But I could be wrong, to quote certain other people on the podcast. And anybody who does know that, let us know.
Yeah.
You know, just because we've been asking a lot of David, and he's just performed it so admirably, just knowing these random facts. David, what number is in my head right now?
32.
Ah, 42.
All right. That's the news.
You're kidding.
Unless anyone has any other news items they'd like to bring up.
No.
This past week, Frontier announced Wi-Fi on the E90s and E170s. I could talk about that for an hour if you want.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
Again, our guest is Jonathan Heckman. He's from the jetcheck.net blog. Jonathan, how long have you been blogging? It's been a while, I think, hasn't it?
It's been since, I want to say, July of 2008, but the blog has gone through a series of name changes
Yeah, it's tough. I've been trying to keep up with it, and it's kind of tough.
It started off as an aviator's blog, then went to Aviation Buzz. That name stuck for a while, and then went to Jet Check.
What precipitated the name changes?
Well, an aviator's blog, well, I didn't really feel like an aviator as I was writing about industry news. And then Aviation Buzz, I thought, oh, that's catchy. But then as soon as I was approached by the Seattle Post-Intelligencer to write a reader blog for them, they're like, well, come up with some blog name. So I suggested Jet Check, and you know, that's what they put. So then I had two blogs running. I had Jet Check on the Seattle PI, and then I had Aviation Buzz running. And then it was just a lot of work writing for each one, writing different posts. And I was like, consolidation at its best right here. So
I take it you primarily focus on airline issues?
Airline, I try and stay out of the aircraft manufacturing as much as I can, even though it says that in my tagline, I guess. Mm-hmm. The Aubrey Cohen over at the CLPI does a great job covering Boeing, of course. So I just write mainly about airlines, airports, anything I do here at Embry-Riddle. We just went on a Tampa International Airport tour. That was great. So got a chance to blog about that. So cool stuff like that.
I was going to ask you, where the inspiration comes for the posts. But I mean, I guess you sort of answered that a little bit there. So just the kind of the activities you're involved in, what you run across in the news and at school, and that's kind of where you get your inspiration.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we have a lot going on here at Embry-Riddle. Going back to that green fleet discussion, I wanted to talk about Embry-Riddle. They're actually going to be implementing they're partnering with Swift Aviation or someone like that. Mm-hmm. Swift Enterprises, I'm sorry, to do biofuel for Embry-Riddle's fleet, which is pretty large fleet, about 80 aircraft or so. So
yeah, right.
So it's happening in all facets, and you know, it's just great to write about it.
What is that deal like for the biofuel? Is there development work that's required?
I believe they're testing it on the Piper Seminoles first. That's what I believe. I'm not sure if that's true. Yeah, I know they had a branding contest for students. If you came up with the logo, it would be put on the plane or whatever. But yeah, so it's actually a fleet of 93 aircraft that they're looking to make all biofuel dependent.
Are there any piston airplanes running on biofuel now?
Not that I know of.
So except for the fact that they don't have it running on piston airplanes, it's going to be, okay, well, it's a good start.
Yep. So they say, you know, small aircraft burn about 190 million gallons of aviation fuel a year. That's 45% of lead emissions to the nation's air. So this is really just implementing this into general aviation in general is a big step, I think.
Could you run that number by me again? What you said they burn how many gallons of fuel, and it's equal to what?
According to the press release, they say 190 million gallons of aviation fuel a year, and contributes to 45% of the lead emissions of the nation's air.
Ah, the lead. Sure, it's generating a lot of the lead. And didn't I see something recently about sort of the end of leaded avgas coming?
Mm. Yeah, they just can't make the engines run on it yet.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a problem, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, random fact about avgas, because it has a finance implication. So that's why I can actually say something. But that's one reason that Cape Air actually did well during the 2008 oil issues, because they were on avgas and that didn't spike like jet fuel. Random fact.
Hmm.
You can feel free to edit out that random fact that really...
No, I'm just sort of contemplating that. Yeah.
That's what keeps them coming back, Dan.
Well, I try to appeal to our key demographics as identified by the non-existent Nielsen podcast ratings.
So, Jonathan, at Embry-Riddle, what are the students at Embry-Riddle interested in these days? What are you finding? Is it people looking to become pilots or people looking to enter into other aviation-related careers? Have you got a sense for that?
Probably about 50% or maybe a little bit more is aeronautical science degree majors, which is learning to become a pilot. So they go through the rigorous flight training here and, you know, go through all the ratings and get everything up to about commercial multi rating. And then a good 20% or 30% or so is about engineering. We have, I believe, according to U.S. News and World Report, we're the number one aerospace engineering program in the United States. So we have a good amount of engineers. As for business in my neck of the woods, it's very limited. So it's about, I want to say, 60 business majors in my freshman class. So It's very limited. It's great to interact with all these types of people who are in every facet of the industry. So you learn a lot just from talking to people here about what's flying like, you know, what's becoming a pilot like, what's maintenance like, engineering like. So it's really great for anyone that, you know, wants to learn a lot about aviation and the industry.
Most importantly, this is the most important question though, of the entire student body, what percentage is women?
I knew this was coming. It's about, I want to say, I think it's 16% is the latest data.
Wow.
I think that's a big improvement actually.
I think it used to be 14 last year. So
yeah. So okay. So if I okay. So chances have improved. Okay.
Slightly.
Very slightly.
Jonathan, how long is the program you're in? How many years does that run?
It's a 4-year program.
So you have some time for the economy to recover before you're out there in the job market, I guess.
Yeah. Hopefully, it'll be perfect timing. So that's what I'm hoping for.
The folks coming out now are probably a little nervous.
Oh yes, oh yeah. We have a lot of people in the local areas who are just waiting for jobs, just at restaurants, you know, doing those types of jobs until they can get picked up by airlines.
Yeah, because I guess maybe John, you know this off the top of your head or not, but how is it by major? Because I have to feel for the aeronautical science majors, they have to be hurting a little bit right now. Rob's eating or something, but I have to feel like
didn't
maybe
eat anything.
Okay, whatever. I feel that maybe on the engineering side, that's a major that's slightly more recession-proof.
This is true. Big manufacturers like Boeing, Lockheed, they're still picking up a good amount of people, which is very nice. But just for the aeronautical science, which is a huge percentage, just really hurting in that area. Air traffic control also... they usually have to spend about a year on the wait list before they get picked up by Oklahoma City for training.
Yeah,
it'll come back though.
Well, I'm still impressed that there are that many people willing to, and I mean this honestly, willing to go to school and perfectly aware of I'm going to be getting crap regional airline pay for X number of years.
Well, yeah, you're dropping a ton of money just for these ratings. I mean, I think you can go elsewhere for cheaper, to be honest, and then come to Embry-Riddle and transfer to ratings, which is nice. Some schools don't let you do that, but Embry-Riddle does, which is a nice factor for why some people do go get their ratings somewhere and then come here.
You guys want to do a little word association?
Sure.
David's so tired, you can just eat.
I know, David. David's at the tail end of a long trip, I guess. Jonathan, what we do is... we play this little game called Word Association. And each of us just thinks of a word or a phrase, and then you just start talking about whatever comes to mind. So it's just kind of a conversation starter.
Okay.
So, Dan, do you have a word for Jonathan?
It's actually a name, so it's a couple words. This one should be pretty easy. Philadelphia International Airport.
Hey!
At David's home plate.
So I have to talk about anything about the airport.
Yeah, anything that comes to mind, just
first
for David's
thing that
sake.
Pops to mind.
Yes. Yeah.
The Terminal E expansion, actually, it's the first thing that comes to mind. They just expanded Terminal E, so Southwest Airlines has most of the gates at Terminal E, and then AirTran has about two, so that's what comes to mind.
Yeah, and from what I've seen, it looks beautiful. So.
Yeah, it's actually, the rest of the airport looks kind of Russian, but other than that.
Well, I think you're being a little mean to your home airport there. I think BNC, bleh, D, bleh, E is nicer now. I think A West is gorgeous.
Of course.
But I think actually, to give U.S. Airways credit, I think Terminal F is a very, very, very nice RJ terminal.
Oh yes, I think U.S. Air is doing, you know, fantastic job with slowly upgrading the airport. Terminal F, yes, very nice. I think that was constructed along with Terminal A West. So both are very beautiful terminals. But if you go into A East right now, it's going under complete overhaul. It's not very pretty to walk home to when you're flying American and you're stuck in A East.
Yeah. Now, what interesting fact? I just looked up the numbers. Just mainline U.S. Airways is only 35% of the total U.S. Airways departures in Philly now.
Right,
which is astounding to me.
Well, I think I believe a majority of it is regional. so many feeder flights that come in.
Well, if it's 35 main lines, so yeah, it's about 65 regional.
Right.
So. That seems really high. That's amazing.
Well, granted, a lot of that is E-170s and E-175s using the mainline gates, but yeah, still.
All right, David, do you have a word for Jonathan?
Okay, this should tell you how really tired I am, guys. Airplane geek.
Oh, lazy.
No, that's a good one. Go ahead. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Airplane geek. Well, something I was called in kindergarten, probably.
Really?
Ooh, good answer.
Yeah. Did your interest started at a really young age?
Ever since I could crawl, I wanted to fly or do something with airplanes. But eventually that transferred into an industry obsession, not so much to flying, but I still love flying. But I think it's an honor to be called an airplane geek sometimes. Now it's an honor, but back then maybe not so much. So,
Jonathan, where did you watch locally?
I've watched the same place since that I actually fly out of now, which is Wings Field in Bluebell, Pennsylvania.
Good old Wings Field.
It's the birthplace of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, so some history there for you.
Good point.
So you also grew up hanging around the Grove like I did?
Yeah, Willow Grove, yep. There's air shows every year. Went to those. Phenomenal.
But did you notice that David doesn't sound the same as Jonathan? I mean, they don't sound like they're from the same neck of the woods.
No, that's because I talk Joisey.
Ah, I see. Okay.
And sometimes Australian, I've noticed lately.
Oh, you noticed that, eh?
Yeah.
Picked that up on the last podcast, eh?
Yes, I did. All right, Rob, do you have a word?
Pink slip.
Pink slip. Actually, cars comes into mind first.
Okay. Oh, good answer.
Oh, man, yeah. But, so what's your favorite car?
Lexus ISF.
Ah.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, 5.0 liter V8. You got to check that out.
Though, considering that, John, we both want to work in the airline industry, I'm not sure how attainable the Lexus is without an insane amount of debt. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
That may take a while to save for.
I'll stick to my Camry right now. I love it.
Okay, Jonathan, I've got one. It's a phrase kind of light sport aircraft.
This is where he says Lexus again, right?
Yeah.
I've always wanted to fly a light sport aircraft, but I never have really gotten the opportunity. But less hours required to get the rating, which is
nice. Right.
Training looks pretty straightforward, but there are more restrictions, I believe. But yeah, I definitely want to try that. It looks like a ton of fun. But the Diamond is pretty close to that.
Right, the one that you fly?
Yep.
Is that an Embry-Riddle plane? Or?
That comes from the Wings Field, Montgomery County Aviation. They rent it out. And then I get flight instruction from there. And they actually have some Embry-Riddle alums. So.
Okay. Well, again, thanks, Jonathan, for joining us this episode. Why don't you tell our listeners where people can find you online?
You can find me on jetcheck.net or on the Seattle Post-Intelligencer reader blogs under JetCheck.
And you're on Twitter also, I believe?
Yep, Twitter under JetCheck.
Okay, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, John.
Thanks. See ya. See ya.
And now with This Week in Aviation, it's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 12, April 25th through May 1st. April 25th, 1972, Hans Werner Gross sets a new sailplane distance record of 1,460 kilometers, or 908 miles, in a Schlechter ASW-12. The flight was from Lübeck to Bizarre. The record stood for 30 years as the absolute distance record for sailplanes. April 27, 1913, Robert G. Fowler makes the 57-minute flight across the Isthmus of Panama, becoming the first pilot to fly from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
How long did it take him?
Oh, it's great.
Approximately an hour.
Okay.
April 28th, 1967, McDonnell Aircraft Corporation merges with Douglas Aircraft Corporation to become McDonnell Douglas. April 29th, 1977, British Aircraft Corporation, Hawker Siddeley Aircraft Aviation, Hawker Siddeley Dynamics, and Scottish Aviation are combined under British law to become British Aerospace. And the next one's for Dan, May 1st, 1982. American Airlines launches AA Advantages, the world's first frequent flyer program. It is still one of the largest in the world. Now, first flights that occurred during the week of April 25th through May 1st. I saw this come up and I couldn't believe it. April 27, 2005, the Airbus A380 Super Jumbo. It's 5 years old already, folks. April 26, 1962, the first unofficial flight of Oxcart, the Lockheed A-12, which was the predecessor of the SR-71. Mm. The official first flight occurred on April 28, 1962. April 28, 1927, the Ryan NYP. Okay, Dan, do you know what the Ryan NYP is? And if you don't know this, you're going to get smacked.
Oh, there's motivation. I use that with my students, too. It works very well.
I don't know.
Are you serious? There's this guy. Yes. He's called the Lone Eagle. He flew from New York to Paris all by himself.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
His name was Lindbergh. The aircraft he flew was the Spirit of St. Louis.
I'm sorry.
But officially, the aircraft's designation was the Ryan NYP.
I'm a failure.
Of note, the Ryan NYP was retired April 30th, 1928, 367 days later.
I failed. I deserve all the hate mail I get.
Okay. Your homework this summer is to get your butt across the mall and go see it.
Yeah. This is true. I will be, while in D.C., I will be visiting Air and Space quite often.
April 30th, 1946, the Grumman G-73 Mallard amphibian first flew. And that's the way it was April 25th through May 1st. This is David signing off.
Thank you, David.
Yay, David.
Hey, David, can I add one thing to something that you mentioned?
Sure.
When I was down at Sun and Fun last week, they had the Lindbergh dinner, which is basically a foundation that gives money out to people who have ideas that are kind to the environment and that sort of thing. And they had Charles Lindbergh's grandson up kind of introducing the whole program. And it was really interesting because he was talking about what he remembered when he was little, being at his grandparents' house and seeing all these people that he didn't know at the time were famous, famous aviation people. And it was really a hoot to listen to him pop off the names and then some little thing he remembered about them that had nothing to do with their qualifications for the aviation industry. But it was really cool. It was pretty cool.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, April 25th, 2010, Anzac Day.
Well, there's a familiar voice. G'day, folks. Welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 94 on the Airplane Geek Show. I'm Steve Vischer, and welcoming him back from the jungles of Indonesia is Grant McHaren. How are you, mate?
Hey, not too bad, man. I've been out there fighting dengue fever, recalcitrant orangutans, and really crap internet connections. But I'm back, and is it really episode 94? I am so far behind. I go away for 2 weeks, and the backlog of podcasts to listen to is enormous.
Yeah, well, obviously you haven't heard last week's yet because we had a stand-in for you last week, and I'm not sure who he was, but he did a great job.
Oh, okay. I'll have to try and dig that one out and listen to it. I haven't had a chance to do anything since I got back except sleep.
Okay, folks, we're going to do something a little bit different on the Ausdesk this week. We're going to welcome into the segment one of our semi-regular contributors on Plane Crazy Down Under, and that is Owen Zupp. G'day, Owen.
G'day, guys. How's it going?
Great. Now, we're going to talk a bit on this segment about what your project is. You're about to do a flight around Australia in what our American listeners would class as an LSA, a Jabiru 230.
That's right, yeah.
This flight's just about to kick off, so maybe just give us a bit of a background on what you're going to do and why you're doing it.
Right, well, it's departing on May 5th from a Queensland or northern township of Bundaberg, where one of Australia's pioneer aviators, Bert Hinkler, hailed from, and it's a multi-purpose flight, really. Firstly, it's the centenary of powered flight in Australia in 2010, whereas it was 1903 when the Wright brothers took to the skies. It is 1910 in Australia before that took place. So to mark that centenary, I thought it'd be a good catalyst to get a flight going around Australia. And second purpose was to raise funds for a very worthy cause in Australia, the Royal Flying Doctor Service, which also hails back to 1928. And that service has supported the outback community of this country for all those years in both emergency care and regular clinic care for people who wouldn't really normally have access to medical services. So tying in the centenary of aviation and supporting a cause like the Royal Flying Doctor were two great causes. And finally, just to make people aware that we really do have an aviation industry here in Australia beyond the airline, something that is tangible, feasible and affordable.
Yeah, and the sponsorship that you've got here, you've got many, many sponsors, but the principal sponsor here is Jabiru Aircraft, which we know there's a number of, or a large number of examples of Jabiru in the United States. That's actually an Australian company.
That's correct, yeah. They're built and designed in Australia out of their Bundaberg facility, and they're found all around the world. And it's one of the sort of unknown stories in Australia in the aviation industry that they even exist. But hopefully that's going to change over the next few weeks as I fly around Australia. And they've built the best part, I think, of 2,000 airframes, and 6,000 of their engines have found their way into aircraft around the world as well. So it's not a small concern.
Yeah, no, I think it's great that you're doing this, Owen, and definitely the raising of awareness of what Aussie aviation can do. And you're touring around a number of very historical sites around Australia, is my understanding.
Yeah, the routing for the flight was probably one of the greatest challenges whenever you're looking at circumnavigating a country and taking in 7,000 to 7,500 nautical miles. You still can't tie in every waypoint that you want. But along the way, there's places such as the founding home of Australia's international airline, Qantas, which is Longreach. It looks at Cloncurry, which is where the Flying Doctor first operated out of back in 1928, up to Darwin, where all those pioneer aviators coming out from England first landed, around the west coast and across central Australia and down Tasmania. So there's a lot of aviation significant points on that route, and a lot of aviation points that are somewhat forgotten, such as a place on the West Australian coast where one of our first air services ended in tragedy, and those two aviators are buried there. And I'll actually be camping at the homestead where their final resting place is on one of the overnights. So there's some interesting stories. Not just the big stories, there's some really interesting stories, and those are what ultimately dictated where I flew.
I understand one of the spots you're going to land at and hang out at for a little while is Point Cook here in Melbourne.
I will be stopping at Point Cook and going to the RAF Museum there. I also hope to get some footage of the parade ground, etc., because that's where my own father graduated from the Air Force about 60 years ago. But I'll actually be departing once I've been through the museum and the parade ground, etc., and I'll be overnighting that night at Shepparton, just to the north of the Ranges.
Point Cook's pretty important for Australia. It was the birthplace of the Royal Australian Air Force, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It's been a bit under fire these days, as airfields often are, because the operational parts of the Air Force have moved further afield from Point Cook, but it is still historically very significant because, as you say, it's really the home ground of the Royal Australian Air Force. And it does support still the Royal Australian Air Force Museum and a lot of significant aircraft there. So it's got original buildings, and I said the parade ground and the barracks that my father trained and paraded on and slept in some 60 years ago. So there's been a lot of pilots go through since he did too. So it's very significant to our aviation history.
And very significant to yourself too, Owen. As we mentioned, it is Anzac Day here, and we might discuss a bit after you sign off why Anzac Day is significant. But your father is was a war veteran.
He served in World War II in the Australian Army in New Guinea, out of a place called Wewak up on the northern coast of New Guinea. And that was with a unit called the 2nd 10th Cavalry Commando Squadron. And when the war came to a close, he actually was in one of the first units that went to Hiroshima with the occupation force, and he spent a year or so up there before returning home. He went into civilian life cutting cane for a while before re-enlisting in the Air Force, and that led him into his second stint in the military as a fighter pilot. And he actually, I believe this is going to the United States, he actually served alongside United States Air Force units with 77 Squadron of the Australian Air Force, flying fighter jets, Gloster Meteors to be precise, in Korea during the Korean conflict. He was based out of Kim Depot.
Okay, Owen, well, that's just a really fascinating background there on what you're doing. We thought it would be important as your flight's about to kick off on May 5th. We thought it'd be great to let our US listeners and all our other listeners around the world too know about your flight. And your website is at thereandback.com.au.
That's right, yeah. It's got a lot of information there now that's been updated about the flight, etc. And anyone who's interested in Anzac, though, there is actually a profile there on Dad's service in Korea and New Guinea brief, and a few photos of him in a fighter jet and things. So it's got a bit of diversity. There's obviously the details of the flight, but there's a bit there for everyone with an interest in aviation, a few flight tests, etc. So if anyone's interested, go to thereandback.com.au and follow the flight and read a bit about aviation.
Absolutely. And if you'd like to find out more about Owen and Owen's story and his background in aviation, of course, we're in the middle of producing episode 31 of Playing Crazy Down Under, but Owen actually featured in episode number 13. You can hear all about Owen's story. It's a really interesting one. Owen, are you allowed to tell us which airline you fly for these days?
Yeah, I fly for Qantas.
And we're not too jealous about that, are we, Grant?
So passing through Long Reach will have dual significance for me.
Absolutely. It's really great that we can have you briefly here on the Australia desk. It's something a little different to what we normally do on our on the times that we meet online, but we'll have you on again in a very near future episode of Playing Crazy Down Under. But thanks very much for joining us on this segment today.
Thanks, guys. It's always great to chat with you, and good day to all your listeners overseas as well.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, see ya.
Well, there you go, Grant. That was good of Owen to join us just quickly there in the Oz desk. Folks, we thought you'd find it interesting to hear what Owen's up to and what he's about to embark on. And you heard David and I speaking last week about the size of Australia and how big it is. So it's no small undertaking what he's doing, flying around the nation in a small aircraft like the Jabiru 230. So, folks, yeah, drop across to his website, thereandback.com.au, and see what he's doing and show him your support.
Yeah, definitely, mate. What Owen's doing is absolutely amazing. And to do it in an aircraft that, while registered as a VHGA aircraft, can technically be a light sport for those of you in America. That makes it all the more impressive. Sort of like going all the way around the outside of the United States. Very impressive stuff. But yeah, meanwhile, as we discussed with Owen, and we are actually recording on Anzac Day. What is Anzac Day? It's a very special day here for those of us in Australia and New Zealand. It's a remembrance of all Australian and New Zealand soldiers who have fought in previous wars and various military actions. Especially those who have died. It all springs from the Gallipoli invasion back in World War One.
ANZAC actually stands for Australia and New Zealand Army Corps. It's probably similar to Veterans Day in the United States, but very, very important here to remind people of the sacrifices that were made by our soldiers in not only the First World War, but all wars in which soldiers of Australia and New Zealand have been involved in. And just to remind our children and everybody else for that matter just what a horrible thing war is and how fortunate people like Grant and myself are that we have not had to go and participate in one ourselves. And we owe that good fortune to the people who fought for us.
A lot of people talk about honouring and remembering the dead and things like that. And I think the best way we can honour those who've died in wars is to try and make sure they never happen again. You know, as many have said there who have been in war, I would never want anyone to go through what I have gone through. Sadly, the world has not realised that and we don't stop it. Yeah, the best thing we can do to honour those who've died fighting for the country is to try and make sure that no one ever has to fight for that country ever again.
Very well said, mate. So, yeah, we might just leave it there. I would make one note this morning, Grant, as we were at our local Anzac Day ceremony here in the town where I live. We were actually fortunate enough to have a quick flyover by the Royal Australian Air Force demonstration team, the Roulettes. So that was a bit of a privilege. Cool. We don't see them very often down here in this part of Melbourne. So great to see them flying over in their Pilatus PC-9s. So there you go, folks. We might just leave it there for the Australia desk this week on a serious note. But as we say, it is an important day here in Australia. So until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers.
Ciao, y'all.
Wow. Talk about a high energy episode.
Yeah, pretty good, huh?
And I especially liked how by having that wonderful guest, it cut down on the amount of time that Steve and Grant talked.
Oh, you're never going to get any more presents from those guys.
I haven't gotten any periods, so I mean, I might as well. I'm kidding. I love you guys. That was a very good interview.
I, on the other hand, think that Grant and Steve do a marvelous job, and that there's however time's a wasting. Wink, wink, nod, nod.
So, Rob, what do you think about circumnavigating Australia in a Jabiru? I guess they said, what, about 7,000 miles? Can you kind of describe what that's like?
It's a long flight. I mean, a Jabiru. I mean, the whole light sport aircraft movement operates on these light aircraft that are provided that are powered by engines that turn very, very high RPMs. They're geared, I mean, in the 5,000 RPM range, 5,000-6,000 RPM, and they're geared down to a smaller or a slower speed, I should say, for the propeller. But it still makes for a lot of vibration and. 70. Well, figure that even if he did 100 miles an hour or 100 knots, which I don't even think he can do, it's probably less than that. He's probably talking 80 flying hours. That's quite a lot of flying, but it is an incredible experience because I doubt he's going to fly much higher than probably 1,000 feet off the ground.
Oh, so that'd be just beautiful looking at the scenery along the way.
It's just great.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, on to listener mail.
We have listener mail. You said we had a whole bunch.
We did have quite a lot, so just had to touch on a little bit of it. John wrote in to talk about the issue of fees on the airlines and them not being taxed, and we talked about that a little bit. But he made some points on that. You can all of these you can see in the comments at the airplanegeeks.com website. So we thank John for writing in on that. Also, we got a note from Eric. He's a new listener. He said he stumbled across us from by way of Brett Snyder, a.k.a. the Cranky Flyer. Eric is a huge airplane, especially airline nerd, he says. He really enjoys the news, humor, entertainment, and commentary you guys provide every week. I really like the variety of opinions and experts you have on the show. I live in Wichita and have had the privilege of hearing Rob speak here and have seen Dan around the social media scene. So it's cool to hear from these smart and witty guys every week. Smart and witty guys.
So, see, these are the emails that keep us going. By the way, Eric,
Dan, I hate to tell you this. He's probably not talking about you because you're hardly ever on.
No, and I was going to say that, I mean, Eric, you don't have to, lie and say that it's a privilege to hear Rob speak.
Eric. We're loving it, bud. So you just keep up the good work.
We also got an email from Sean. He made a good point about the economic impact of the volcanic ash episode we recently had. He writes, we're constantly hearing about how it's costing the airlines X amount of dollars every day, which is massive. And they probably haven't seen this kind of a hit since 9/11, which could be devastating. But also, let's not forget the hurt that the hotels, restaurants, rental cars, tourist attractions, et cetera, all over the world that are losing money in this, as well as from the stranded travelers not making it to their destinations. So I thought that was a good point.
Were they looking for a bailout or what?
Well, yeah.
I have to think that some, I don't know this for sure, but maybe some hotels over in Europe did okay with people being stranded.
Well, I had a friend of mine. Well, you guys know Max Trescott from maxtrescott.com.
We've had him on.
Geeky guy. In fact, he was due to come back from his daughter's in Ireland last week and got stuck over there. And he said the hotel was just pleased as punch to have him and his wife stay on an extra 6 days.
Yeah, I bet there really was kind of a broad economic impact as a result of this, but both positive and negative.
Well, he said something about the fact that there was a great deal of beer that needed to be consumed.
Well, yeah, and I saw in one news report where the people had to sort of stay close to the airport. They never knew exactly when they might be leaving, and they only had a narrow window once it was announced that they had a flight. So that prevented people who might have otherwise gone out into the countryside or lengthened their vacation or whatever to see the sights. They really didn't have the opportunity to do that in all cases.
Sounds just like what they tell you when you're on the ramp at the airport. Sorry, we can't go back to the gate because you may lose your spot in line.
Maybe there should be a fine for that, too.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, I like that.
And then finally, Kim wrote in, as he often does, with some good thoughts. He says, just one thought on the great show, guys. David, did you really say that you did not want, quote, some grunt, unquote, to throw your bag on the wrong flight? Surely you didn't mean it the way it sounded. One of the largest customer service problems the airlines have these days is a result of their considering all Their below-the-wing personnel is just, quote, some grunts, meaning interchangeable minimum-wage robots. The resulting mess on the ramp, mishandled bags, fueling problems, tow accidents, etc., is a direct result. As for why the airlines can't get the bags to the claim area faster in this modern age, it's because they do it the same way they've done it for 50-plus years. One bag at a time, muscled out of the bag bin by a ramper on his knees, onto a conveyor belt, manually onto the bag cart, drive to the terminal, onto another belt, and up to you. Of the aircraft I flew, only the 767 had containerized baggage to make this process more efficient. The 757, with 184 passengers, had to be manually unloaded one bag at a time.
So what Kim's implying is, after United, Continental, and U.S. Airways create the UAV tanker force, they're going to set forth and create a UAV ground personnel force that will manipulate the baggage from the airplane to the terminal without any people touching it at all, thus making it quicker.
Hey, as long as it's quicker, I'd be happy.
That should be a service on the, what was the airline that we were creating last week?
Oh, Bottom Feeder Airline.
Bottom Feeder Airline.
Look, I think this will all work fine until all the robots will become self-aware and develop human emotions.
Thank you, Isaac Asimov. All right, we'd like to thank our guest again, Jonathan Heckman. John, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And be sure to check out his blog at jetcheck.net. Also, thanks to Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron for their Plane Crazy Down Under Australia Desk report. And again, make sure you check out Owen Zupp's site. That's at thereandback.com.au. Mostly, we'd really like to thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't do this if you weren't there. Maybe that's kind of obvious, right?
Well, or would we? Because we don't know that they are there.
Oh, they're there. Let me tell you. They make sure they let us know.
Let's be serious. Where is there? Where is there?
It's not here.
Yeah, well, it's not here. Yes, that's a good point.
Okay. Let's see. Rob, if people want even more of you, where can they find you?
Who would want that?
Okay, I'm not laughing at that. I was laughing at something else at the same time. I don't find that kind of remark funny. However, I do feel it's well-deserved after all the picking we do on Dan. Actually, where they could find me is jetwine.com or jetwine on Tweety.
Twitter.
Or Twitter. Well, I tweet on...
You tweet on Twitter.
I tweet on Tweety. This is going to get very... David, I think I'm with you. I think it's time for a nap.
Nap? Oh, wait.
David's already fallen asleep. David, before you totally pass out, where can folks find you online?
You can find me on Tweety at DM Vanderhoof, or you can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com with an occasional saunter through the Australian universe at Plane Crazy Down Under.
Great. And Dan Webb?
Well, you can find me on my blog, thingsinthesky.com, and I promise we're going to have some exciting stuff this week, like United changing the way they accounted for unused frequent flyer miles, resulting in a $64 million increase in revenue for the first quarter, because I know everyone's excited about that.
I can hardly wait.
Yeah. And you can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. You can follow the Airplane Geeks on Twitter at Airplane Geeks. You can send us email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Also, be sure to check out our Facebook page. David has arranged to make it even easier, so you can key in facebook.com/airplanegeeks and find our fan page there. We'd really love it if you call our listener line and leave us a message there.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
And before we go, though, I still want to know what Grant's comment was about the... What did he say? Something about outrageous orangutans or something on his trip?
Yeah, he had some kind of problem with the primates, I guess.
Grant has just got to get out more, but obviously someplace else.
All right. Thank you all for listening. Join us next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Goodbye.
Summertime.
But why don't we get started straight away with the news? You guys ready?
Yay!
Oh, please, okay, Max, so we say can, you can.
Yes, say, tell us you can cut that out.
I mean, right, actually, well, hold on once. Oh, crap. Hold on, outtake. Crap. I had the thing, and it's just, hold on a second.
You know, since you've been gone, I leave all these in, you know.
Damn it.
That's because we don't screw up as much as you do.
Oh, shut up.
One question I've always wondered, though, why is it not Mobile, Alabama?
Because someone down there at one point decided that it was going to be Mobile, Alabama, and that's the way it stuck. Like my grandpapa always said.
I feel we might get hate mail for that, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either.
I tried to connect my iPhone on the Wi-Fi on the an American MD-80 coming back from someplace.
Did it work
last week? And it didn't work.
Dan, you're breathing into the mic again.
I'm sorry.
Pick up. So you couldn't get connected at all, huh?
Nope. Tried the laptop, tried the phone. Flight attendants had no idea what to tell me. And I just said, never mind.
Yeah, so. You really probably can't expect flight attendants to provide technical support for connectivity.
Yeah, I mean,
problems.
First we make them waitresses. Now we want them to be IT people.
That's right.
And they have to be psychologists. It's a tough life.
Yeah, well, and plus, I'm not sure if you saw the news story this past week, but you expect them to be like fourth-degree black belts in Taekwondo.
Yeah,
that's right.
I wouldn't want that job. I mean, there's a reason the pilots go up front, turn left, and lock the door.
It's a tough job back there. Yeah.
No,
pilots wouldn't last one flight in the back.
This is why pilots sometimes call us self-loading freight.
Okay, folks, I'm going to apologize up front. This is not my usual quality work, but I figured I couldn't come to the party without anything. So this one's going to be really quick.
So is it bad too? Is it like, you know, on July 3rd, 1803?
Okay,
Dan. Does this have anything to do with your work with the ruse?
No. Okay. It was the fact that I spent the whole weekend not home.
I mean, as much as we love those guys down under, I mean, I just... You know, we don't want them tiring you out.
Yes, they're not monopolizing my time all the time.
Remember where your paycheck comes from.
Not from here.
Wait a minute. Free stuff from Australia.
Wait a minute. They're sending you free stuff?
They send me stuff all the time. They love
Where's
me
my free stuff?
Hey, where's my free stuff, you kangaroo guys? Hey,
well, look, it's fair.
I didn't even get a JetWine sticker at Christmas.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It was fair because Max and I got JetWine buttons and David didn't. So, right. Rob, we can
I
only blame
you. You eventually got yours, David.
You never sent me one. But that's okay. Let's get to the history segment.
Right.
Guys,
oh, right. You're supposed to be doing your segment. Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
All right, David, you going to be able to hang in there or are you about ready to fall asleep?
No, I'm good. I'm good for another 15 minutes, and then we're done.
All right.
Then the Ambien kicks in.
All right. Well, why don't we hear something from our favorite Australians?
No.
Yeah, can we have a show of hands on this?
You want to vote?
Well, I think I just want to know that
I have to abstain.
I'd be very interested in hearing anything that Grant and Steve have to say. If they're, you know, when they're sending people things that they sent them to everyone. I mean, no pressure or anything. I don't know. What do you think about that, Dan?
Yeah, let's hold the segment hostage until we get our free crap.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, Mr. Vischer, sticking the knife in deeper, he was on Skype last night. He IM'd me, oh, look at this new addition to the... to the Vischer fleet. It was this nice little model of a Virgin Blue 737.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's cool. And then I noticed, I think there is another motive here because right behind that, guess what picture is framed? Steve Vischer and Leo Laporte.
Oh.
Yeah, I've seen that photo. It's great.
Yeah. So I think he was just bragging just with a different excuse.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's give them a pass on this one. I mean, maybe we simply dropped off their mailing list, Dan.
Well, g'day, folks, and well, you're right to go, Grant.
Sorry. I was going to say, do you want me to do the dateline?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I always forget that. Yeah, go for it.
Okay, here we go. Dateline. Great start. Yeah. Okay, here we go.
So, dude. Okay. Okay. 2 weeks in the jungle and you've lost it.
Matt Damon.
Here you are giving Matt Damon hates.
There's the first outtake of the session.
And I've been away for 2 weeks mucking with the monkeys and look at it. I can't go with it. But anyhow, here we go.
And there's a second one. Right, go.
Thanks. 3, 2, 1. Dateline, April 25th, 2010.
Well,
Anzac Day. I thought I'd throw that extra bit in.
Do it again quickly. Come on.
And we also encourage single ladies to call Dan. Because,
that's right.
Yes.
Any voicemails for Dan will get directly forwarded to him for sure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Rob.
Okay. Yeah. If they wanted to send pictures, though, to David, Max, and I, we'd be happy to kind of
pre-screen,
you know, organize it for you, prioritize them.
Pre-screen.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how many people would be interested in a college-age airplane dork? So you're probably going to have to screen, what, like 2 photos, so...
I think you'll be a fantastic catch, Dan. And I'm sure there's plenty of women out there who would love to ignore you like
the rest of us.